How It Stacks Up by Rose Tremaine was read by Dermot Crowley and produced by Di Spears.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now, The Speckled Band, one with a very dramatic start and a story considered by Conan Doyle himself to be his best Sherlock Holmes tale.
Your affectionate niece, Helen Stoner. Now, dear Aunt Honoria, my deepest thanks for your invitation to spend a little time with you in Harrow after Julia's wedding. Indeed, I feel a short break will be almost necessitated by the excitement of seeing my sister married. Even our stepfather, Dr. Roylott, seems well disposed towards the event. Julia herself has not long left me to go to bed, and even now, I suppose, will be lying awake next door thinking of her happiness to come, while I... My God, Julia! Julia! Julia. Julia, your face. What is it? What is it?
Helen! It...
Oh, my God!
The Speckled Band by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Dramatized for radio by Vincent McInerney. With Clive Medicine as Sherlock Holmes and Michael Williams as Dr. John Watson. And featuring Susan Wooldridge as Helen Stoner. The Speckled Band.
Watson. Watson, old man.
Good heavens, Holmes. A quarter past seven? What on earth is going on?
A client, Watson. A client in a considerable state of excitement.
But who? Why so early?
Who? A young lady. As to why? Well, presumably when people wander about the metropolis at this hour, they have something pressing to communicate, and should it prove an interesting case...
My dear fellow, I would not miss it for anything. Then you've seen her?
Oh, yes. Even said good morning to her. Mrs. Hudson gave her some coffee in the sitting room. I glanced in as I passed. 30 or so, I fancy. Dressed all in black, hair shot with grey, but pitifully agitated, with restless, frightened eyes, like some hunted animal.
Poor soul. It's not just coffee she needs, then, but kindness.
Ah, madam. I am Sherlock Holmes, and this, my intimate friend and associate, Dr. John Watson, before whom you can speak as freely as before myself.
Mr. Holmes, Dr. Watson.
Madam. But you must be cold, I think, travelling at this hour. Come into the main part of the room, I beg you, and draw up to the fire.
It is not cold which makes me shiver, Mr. Holmes.
Indeed, what then?
It is fear, Mr. Holmes. It is terror.
You must not fear, Miss...
Stoner. Helen Stoner?
No, for I have no doubt we shall soon set matters right. You have come in by train this morning, I see, although, of course, you had a journey before that.
You know me, then?
Simply, I observe the second half of a return ticket in the palm of your left glove, while the seven spatters of mud on your left-hand jacket sleeve bespeak time spent along heavy roads sitting next to the driver in a dog cart.
I see Mrs. Farintosh was right in what she said regarding your abilities.
Mrs. Farintosh, I'm not sure I remember.
Before your time, my dear Watson, merely an opal tiara and death by bishoping. Miss Stoner, please sit down.
Oh, thank you.
There. So, you have come far?
The western borders of Surrey to Leatherhead, and then by first train to Waterloo. Mr. Holmes, I can stand the strain no longer. Nor have I anyone to turn to... Save one, Percy. That is a Mr. Armitage, who cares for me very much, but can be of little aid as regards my domestic circumstances. Who indeed seems to think what I am suffering from are the fancies of a nervous woman. But they are not fancies, Mr. Holmes. They are dangers, real dangers. And I must have some help to walk amongst them.
Then, Miss Stoner, you must begin by laying everything in front of us that may help us form an opinion on the matter.
My name, then, as I have said, is Helen Stoner. And I live on the borders of Surrey with my stepfather, who is the last survivor of one of the oldest Saxon families in England, the Roylotts of Stoke Moran.
Roylotts, the name seems familiar, Watson.
Indeed. A long and distinguished history, although somewhat checkered, I believe, towards the end of the...
Regency. Oh, you are right, Doctor. Four dissolute heirs, followed by a gambler, reduced one of the richest families in England to ruin. Lands that once stretched into Berkshire and Hampshire were reduced to a few brambled acres, and the house itself crushed under a heavy mortgage. The last squire dragging out a life of aristocratic poverty. His son, however, my stepfather, saw he must adapt to new conditions, took a medical degree and went out to Calcutta, where by skill, toil and force of character he established a large practice, until a series of robberies occurred on his property in which he thought his native butler was involved.
And?
He beat the man to death.
For which he stood trial?
Only narrowly escaping a capital sentence. It was offered in his defence that he did not know his own strength. And he is physically quite terrifying. As it was, he received a long term of imprisonment, returning to England at the end of it a morose and disappointed man.
But, Miss Stoner, what about... How did...
Dr. Roylott become my stepfather? Mm. In his early days, he met and married my mother, the young widow of Major General Stoner of the Bengal Artillery. My twin sister, Julia, and I were 2 years old when the marriage took place. Julia.
More coffee, Miss Stoner. Here, let me. Watson, you know, is an old India hand.
Afghanistan, actually.
Afghanistan. Here you are, Miss Stoner. And when you're a little more composed, but in your own time.
Yes. Thank you. Well, first, I think you should know, my mother had £1,000 a year at the time of her remarriage, which she settled on our stepfather, but with a provision that should my sister or I marry, we should receive a certain sum from the settlement.
Your mother is dead?
We returned to England 10 years ago. 2 years later, she was involved in a fatal rail accident near Crewe. After her death, Dr. Roylott, who had been attempting to establish himself in practice in London, suggested that we pack up and move back to Stoke Moran. There was enough money for our wants and seemingly no obstacle to our happiness.
I assume he reverted.
Yes. Yes, he did. Our neighbours, who had initially welcomed the return of a Roylott to Stoke Moran, well, sufficient to say two incidents finished in the police courts, while in another he threw the local blacksmith over a parapet into a stream, an indulgence that cost all the money I could gather to prevent further public exposure and disgrace. He has become the terror of the village, and I speak the truth when I tell you the only living things which will have anything to do with him are a cheetah and a baboon he has imported from the East, and a band of wandering gypsies who have his permission to camp on what is left of the estate.
A drear existence.
Drear, solitary, and hard. For, of course, no servant will stay, except a decrepit housekeeper, Mrs. Mims, who hardly knows the days of the week any longer.
So who now runs the house, Miss Stoner?
I do, Doctor. All tasks inside and out. Although until 2 years ago I had Julia to help me. Poor Julia, she was but 30 at her death, and yet her hair had already begun to whiten, even as mine has.
So she too is dead?
Mr. Holmes, it is the events surrounding Julia's death which bring me here today. You understand that, given the circumstances of our life, we saw little of anyone of our own age. We did, however, have an aunt near Harrow we were sometimes allowed to visit at public holidays. There, 2 Christmases ago, Julia met a half-pay major of Marines to whom she became engaged.
Mm, and your stepfather's reaction?
Quite equable. Invited the groom over to the house, spoke with generosity in terms of the forthcoming ceremony, and then, within a fortnight of what was to be the happiest day of my sister's life, the terrible tragedy occurred which deprived me of my only companion.
Miss Stoner, pray be precise as to details.
It is easy for me to be so, Mr. Holmes, for every event of that terrible time is seared into my memory. First, however, you must have some idea of the manner of our life at Stoke Moran. It is, as I have intimated, now ruinous and almost completely closed down, the living accommodation being reduced to the ground floor of one of its two wings, a long corridor off which three bedrooms open, each with a window looking out onto the lawn. First, Dr. Roylott's, then that which was Julia's, with myself at the far end. On that fatal evening, then, 2 years ago, Dr. Roylott had gone to his room early, though not to retire to rest, but rather to smoke. Indeed, it was the pungent smell from his Indian cigars that had initially driven Julia into my room, where we chatted for a time about her approaching wedding.
But, Helen, you must wear a veil as my chief bridesmaid.
In this house, Julia, it is rather as if I've taken one.
Helen, if you are not careful, he will hear you.
Julia, I am not really bothered.
Oh, Helen, had I your insouciance?
The night had been stormy, and about 11 became appreciably worse, at which point Julia felt it was time to retire. So she rose to leave me and had reached my door.
Helen, have you ever heard anyone whistling in the dead of night?
Why, no, Julia, never.
I suppose it could not be you in your sleep.
Julia, dear, I cannot even whistle whilst I am awake. It would hardly have been on Mama's list of attributes every young lady should possess.
I am silly, but you know I am a light sleeper. And, well, these last few nights, about 2 in the morning, I have been disturbed by a low, clear whistle. Though once I am awake, I have no idea where it has come from.
The gypsies in the plantation, perhaps. I believe they have a way of communicating with whistles.
Then why have you not heard it? Your window opens onto the lawn as mine does.
But you are the restless one, my dear.
Of course. Well, it is probably of little consequence. Good night, dear. God bless.
And with that, Julia smiled at me, closed my door, and a few minutes later I heard the key turn in her lock.
This was a regular thing, Miss Stoner, to lock yourself in at night.
The cheetah and the baboon.
Indeed, quite so. Proceed, if you will, Miss Stoner.
I confess that I had treated the affair much more lightly than I had actually felt. As I've already mentioned, we were not only sisters, but twins. The links that bound our souls, both subtle and penetrating. So I knew Julia was ill at ease, frightened, even terrified. I determined I would not sleep. The night wore on, the rain lashing against the windows, the wind howling, when suddenly I sprang from my bed and rushed into the corridor.
Julia!
My sister's door was slowly swinging open. I stared, horror-stricken, not knowing what was going to issue from it.
Julia.
Then slowly, Julia appeared. Her face blanched, her hands groping before her for help, her whole figure swaying like that of a drunkard. She writhed as one who is in terrible pain, and her limbs were dreadfully convulsed. At first I thought she had not recognized me, but as I bent over her, she suddenly shrieked out in a voice I shall never forget.
Helen! Oh, my God, Helen! It was the band! The speckled band!
Then stabbed with her finger towards our stepfather's door, then convulsed yet again, and then...
And then, Miss Stoner?
And then Dr. Roylott appeared in his dressing gown, poured brandy down her throat and sent for aid to the village. But to no avail, for she never recovered consciousness.
And that is all you saw and heard?
No, Mr. Holmes. There was something I thought I heard when first I opened my door. First a low whistle, such as my sister had described, and a few moments later a clang of metal.
You are sure about this? You could swear to it.
I did so to the coroner. And yet, amid the crash of the gale and the creaking of the old house...
And the coroner's verdict, Miss Stoner?
No satisfactory cause of death, no marks of violence. He investigated with great care, not least because of our stepfather's reputation, but my evidence showed all the windows on the ground floor were stopped with wooden shutters, the doors locked on the inside, the chimneys barred across, the floor solid. No, she was alone when whatever it was happened.
And poison?
The doctors examined her without success.
The gypsies were not considered.
Indeed, Mr. Holmes, they were my first thought. I have spoken of their whistling to each other, and then there was Julia's mention of the speckled band. You know how so many of them always wear bandanas or stripes and colours and such around their heads.
Yes, perhaps. These are deep waters. However, your stepfather was in his dressing gown. How then was your sister attired?
In her nightdress. Oh, one other thing. Hmm? In one of her hands was the charred stump of a match. In the other, a matchbox.
Showing she had time to strike a light and look about when the alarm came. How interesting and important.
Tell me, Miss Stoner, immediately after these terrible events, did your stepfather's attitude change? Did he, that is, become more violent, more conciliatory, more thrusting, more retiring?
I could not say. After the funeral, my doctor advised a short holiday. So I went to the Armitages near Reading, a connection of my aunt's. That is where Percy and I... You heard me mention Mr. Armitage earlier.
Of course, yes.
Well, after that visit 2 years ago, Percy and I began a correspondence. A correspondence that in the course of time has... Well, we are to be married in the spring.
Oh, congratulations, Miss Stoner.
Thank you. I told Dr. Roylott, who showed nothing but benevolence and said it would provide an excuse to have some repairs done to the fabric of the house, starting with my room, how the mortar between the stone was crumbling and how some of those same stones must be removed, which of course means...
You have moved into your sister's room.
Quite, Doctor. And now sleep in the very bed she did. Where, last night, I was awakened by a low whistle.
You lit the lamp?
Immediately, but saw nothing. Too shaken to go to bed again, however, I dressed and waited for daybreak, ran to the Crown Inn for a dog cart, and quickly made my way here.
Which means we also must move quickly to see over the rooms of Stoke Moran, preferably when your stepfather is absent. Miss Stoner, is this possible?
As it happens, he too has business in town this morning, and as he seldom returns before nightfall, then today of all days might be your best chance.
Today it will be, after lunch to be exact, for there's much to do first. Almost 8 o'clock. Miss Stoner, should we arrive shortly after one, would you have returned by then?
I think so. There are some things to arrange regarding my wedding, but I fully intend to be home by lunchtime. If Dr. Roylott should return early, perhaps we had better meet outside of the house?
Yes, you have a suggestion?
There is only one path from the station that leads to Stoke Moran, so if you took the local dog cart and I waited in one of the fields alongside that path...
Ah, excellent, excellent. Here, let me hand you your glass.
Oh, thank you.
Miss Stoner, there's marks on your wrist.
Oh, no, really, Dr. Watson, they are nothing.
Impossible to fob off an old medical dog like that, I'm afraid. May I?
Oh.
Bruises. Your stepfather must indeed be physically overwhelming.
I mentioned he is said not to know his own strength.
You have been cruelly used.
It's the generic term, I believe, for those who are said not to know their own strength is bully. Watson, perhaps you could show our guest out. Miss Stoner, we will see you at Stoke Moran sometime early this afternoon.
And with that, Holmes took up his pipe and sat abruptly down in the chair in front of the fire. And putting his chin in his hands, he began staring intently into the crackling flames. I saw Miss Stoner into the street, and then return to our sitting room.
Well, Watson,
a dark and sinister business.
Indeed. Dark enough and sinister enough. And the gypsies?
Well, even taking into account the strange words uttered by Julia, headband, whistles and such. I'm not sure the whole thing might not just be...
What in the name of the devil?
Out of my way, madam! Out of my way! Which of you is Holmes?
This rage-strangulated inquiry, delivered in a voice like a mad bull's, came from a man of huge and terrifying demeanour, whose bulk almost completely filled the doorway. His clothes, too, were as bizarre in their appearance as he was, being an uneasy mixture of plough and pulpit, in that they ranged from a black top hat and long frock coat to a pair of farmer's gaiters and a hunting crop. But there was little Christianity in the face which glowered above the neck stock, for it was a visage seared with a thousand wrinkles, burned yellow with the eastern sun, marked with every evil passion, and containing a pair of deep bile-shot eyes set on either side of a thin, fleshless nose. Overall, in fact, our visitor looked very much like a thoroughly out-of-sorts aging bird of prey, and all the more dangerous because of it.
I said... Which of you is Holmes?
My name, sir. Please come in, if you will, Mrs. Hudson. That will be all. Thank you.
Oh, yes. I'll come in.
I'm afraid you have the advantage of me.
I, sir, am Dr. Grimesby Roylott of Stoke Moran.
Indeed, Doctor. Pray take a seat. Watson, perhaps our guest would like a cushion.
Cushion? I want nothing of the kind. My stepdaughter has been here. I followed her. She suffers from delusions. Now, what's she been saying to you?
It's a little cold for the time of year, I think.
She said that?
The crocuses seem to promise well. In the wrong hands, Dr. Roylott, a hunting crop is a vicious and cowardly weapon, though certainly not as dangerous as the service revolver my associate here always carries about his person to deal with any mad dogs we may chance upon.
I see. I see. Well, I know you, you scoundrel. I've heard of you before. Holmes the meddler. Holmes the busybody. Holmes the Scotland Yard jacket office.
Ah, oh, most entertaining, Dr. Roylott. When you go out, I wonder if I might ask you to close the door. There's a decided draught.
I will go when I've had my say. I'm a dangerous man to fall foul of, Mr. Holmes, especially to those who meddle in my affairs. Here, let me show you. There. An example of my grip, Mr. Holmes. See you keep out of it!
Pass me the poker, Watson, as you fell in. Yeah. Not quite as straight as it was, though Mrs. Hudson will hardly notice the difference. And now to business. You go to Waterloo, if you will, and take two tickets for the first train to Leatherhead after 1 o'clock, mine to be left at the booking office. Mm-hmm. I enter Doctor's Commons, and on the journey, we will compare notes. And if you could, old fellow, an empty compartment.
Shall I take anything?
Your revolver, an Ely's number 2, is an excellent argument with gentlemen who can twist steel pokers into knots. That and a toothbrush are all I think we'll need.
Five hours later, as requested, I chose an empty compartment on the Leatherhead train and watched anxiously from the door. But there was still no sign of him as the guard blew, and we began to move off. About to pull my head in, I suddenly saw Holmes vault over the barrier, deftly deposit his ticket in the top pocket of the astonished collector's waistcoat, and begin to sprint up the platform, from whence he swung himself aboard without a hair out of place, and settled into a corner seat. Then, oblivious to my presence, he drew some papers from his pocket and fell to scribbling and frowning, and scribbling again. For my part, sitting opposite him, I gazed out of the window for a time, and then, what with the steady rattling of the train over the rails, the green of the Surrey countryside, and the bright sun concentrated through the glass window...
What?
No, Holmes.
course. The son, you understand, all that weight.
Yes, yes, but look at this. A copy of the mother's will. Checking her investments, I find the income from them now to stand at about £750. And of this income, each daughter is liable for a third at marriage. Mm. It is evident, therefore, that even one of the girls marrying would cripple Roylott to a serious extent. But if both were to leave home with husbands...
Why, he would be reduced to a mere pittance.
Just through these trees and we're there. Oh, but I am frightened, Mr. Holmes, to learn that Dr. Royle had followed me to your lodgings. His temper
is... Miss Stoner, I assure you that I personally shall deliver you to your aunt at Harrow if needs be. But that will be decided, but... Ah.
And there before us lay the manor house of Stoke Moran. A building of grey, lichen-blotched stone, with a high central portion and two curving wings, like claws of a crab, thrown out on either side. One of these wings, that on our left hand, was in a complete state of disrepair, with its windows out and roof fallen in, while the centre block was little better. But the right-hand wing was comparatively modern, with three windows looking out from it onto the lawn. The end of this block was surrounded by scaffolding.
That end window, I take it, Miss Stoner, belongs to your room, this one to your sister's, and the next one to Dr. Roylott's chamber.
Exactly so, but I am now sleeping in the middle one.
Pending the alterations, as I understand. Miss Stoner, I wonder if you would have the kindness to go into your sister's room, open the hasp of the window, then bar the shutters.
Oh, certainly.
Holmes, there hardly seems to be any pressing need for repairs to this end wall.
No, indeed, nor any workmen around to effect them. That is suggestive.
An excuse, perhaps?
Yes, perhaps. Ah. Thank you, Miss Stoner. Now then. No possibility there. And no room even to get a knife blade in under the bar.
Yes.
Hinges solid, let into the stone. My theory certainly presents some difficulties. What price gypsies now, eh, Watson? No one could pass through these shutters if they were barred. Thank you, Miss Stoner. We shall now join you inside.
It was a homely little room, with a low ceiling and gaping fireplace, after the fashion of old country houses. A brown chest of drawers stood in one corner, a narrow white counterpane bed in another, a dressing table on the left of the window, and two small wickerwork chairs. Holmes drew up one of the chairs and sat silent, while his eyes travelled round and round and up and down, taking in every detail.
That bell pull above the bed, where does it communicate to?
The housekeeper's room.
Yes, it looks newer than the other thing.
Yes, it was only put there a couple of years ago.
Your sister asked for it, I suppose.
Oh, no. I never heard of her using it. We always used to get what we wanted for ourselves.
Yes, just so, if you'll permit. How very interesting.
What, Holmes?
It's not even attached to a wire. It's merely fastened to a hook. Just above the ventilator.
How absurd. I never noticed that before.
Very strange. There are one or two very singular points about this room. For example, what a fool a builder must be to open a ventilator into another room when, with the same trouble, he might have communicated with the outside air.
That is also quite modern.
Yes, done about the same time as the bell rope.
Yes, there were one or two little changes carried out about that time.
They seem to have been of a most interesting character. Dummy bell ropes and ventilators which do not ventilate. With your permission, Miss Stoner, we shall now carry our researches into the inner apartment.
Dr. Roylott's room, though larger than that of his stepdaughter, was plainly furnished. A camp bed with an armchair beside it, a shelf full of books, a round wooden table with a single chair, and a large iron safe.
Miss Stoner, what's in here?
Why, I have only seen into it once, years ago. It was full of my stepfather's papers.
Then he would not say, keep a cat in it.
A cat?
There's this saucer of milk lying at its side.
Oh, I see. Well... That is the cheetah, Mr. Holmes. and the baboon.
With due respect, Miss Stoner, a cheetah is a very big cat, while this is a very small saucer. However, there is one further point I should wish to determine. This chair. That is quite settled. Hello? Oh, here is something interesting. What do you make of that, Watson?
It's a common enough whipcord dog lash.
Yeah, why tied in a loop, though?
I could not say.
Not quite so common, then. It's a wicked world. And when a clever man turns his brain to crime, it is the worst of all. Miss Stoner, it is essential that you now follow my advice in every respect.
I shall certainly do so.
Your life may depend upon your compliance.
I am in your hands.
Then in the first place, both my friend and I must spend the night in your room.
Oh, if it is necessary, of course. But Dr. Roylott...
In a moment, Miss Stoner. Now, that is the village inn across the fields there.
Yes, that is the Crown.
Yes, and this window would be visible from there.
Certainly.
Then when your stepfather comes back, be confined to your room with a headache. Wait for him to retire for the night and open the shutters, undo the window hasp and show a lamp as a signal to us. Then withdraw to your old room and leave the rest in our hands.
I believe, Mr. Holmes, that you have already made up your mind.
Perhaps I have.
Then was it, as I have thought, a sudden fright?
I believe what killed your sister was much more tangible.
We took our leave of the frightened girl and walked across the fields to the Crown, where we engaged a room on the upper floor, commanding a view of the Avenue Gate and the inhabited wing of Stoke Moran Manor House. We ordered and ate an early dinner and took our chairs to the open window and sat in companionable silence as dusk fell.
Watson.
Dr. Roylott.
The gate, boy! The gate!
The trap drove on, and a few minutes later we saw a light spring up among the trees as Roylott lit a lamp in the sitting room.
You know, Watson, I really have some scruples about taking you tonight. There is a distinct element of danger.
Can I be of any assistance?
No, your presence would be invaluable.
Then I shall certainly come.
Oh, thank you.
Look, the light in the sitting room's gone out.
No, it is not yet 9. He's merely closed the shutters. It'll be some time yet before he retires to his chamber. But for one thing, he will want to feel Miss Stoner is asleep.
You evidently saw more in those rooms than I did.
No. Simply deduced a little more. The bell rope, the ventilator.
But so small. A rat could hardly pass through it.
I knew we'd find one even before we came to Stoke Moran.
My dear Holmes.
You recall how Miss Stoner said her sister was driven from her room by the smell of Roylott's cigar. Well, I realized then there must be a small ventilator.
But what harm can there be in it?
Well, there is at least a curious coincidence of dates. Did you observe anything peculiar about the bed?
No.
It was clamped to the floor.
Clamped?
Indeed. It could not be moved, and must therefore always be in the same position relative to the ventilator and the bell rope, as must any head resting upon the pillow.
My God. I seem to see dimly what you're hinting at. How horrible.
Horrible enough. When a doctor goes wrong, he is the first of criminals. And more horrors to come before the night is over. So, for the time being, let us have a quiet pipe and take in the beauty of the moon.
The trees, the night, and so we did. And 2 hours passed slowly away. Then suddenly, at the stroke of 11, a single bright light shone out right in front of us.
That is our signal.
We made our way quietly downstairs and out into the night, Holmes pausing only to take up a thin, whip-like cane from the stand near the inn door.
There was little difficulty entering the grounds of the house, the wall having long fallen into disrepair, and we quickly made our way through the trees, across the lawn, and were just about to pull open the window of Julia Stoner's old room.
What the devil?
No, hold your fire, Watson. It's only the doctor's baboon. Indeed, a nice household.
And the cheetah?
And who died up a tree, waiting to descend on our shoulders. Now, before we go in, you will take one of the chairs, keeping your revolver on your knee, and do not fall asleep if you value your life. I will sit on the side of the bed with a candle and matches, and this. Shortly after we go in, I will put out the light to make him think Miss Stoner has gone to bed. And then, well, then we will see. Right, old fellow. In we go.
How shall I ever forget that dreadful vigil, broken only by the cry of the occasional nightbird outside, and once a long-drawn-out snuffling whine from the window, which told us the cheetah had found us and had come to investigate. But for the rest, no light, no sound, no movement. Nothing but the sense of my companion sitting open-eyed within a few feet of me, and in the same state of nervous tension as myself. Far away, we heard the deep boom of the parish clock as it tolled the quarters, and how long each one seemed. But gradually the hours slipped by. Midnight, one, two, three. Then suddenly a gleam of light appeared at the ventilator, to vanish immediately. A moment later came the strong smell of burning oil and heated metal. Someone in the next room had lit a dark lantern and drawn its shutter. For half an hour, there was no other sound. And then my ears picked up something. Something very strange in being just audible, yet also somehow very soothing. Altogether like a small jet of steam escaping continually from a kettle.
You see it, Watson? You see it?
Where, Holmes? What? What is it, man?
Stay back, Watson. Stay back, man, if you value your life.
The devil, it's escaped me. It's got back.
Back, Holmes? Where? What has?
Good God, Holmes. What was that? What does it mean?
That it's over. And perhaps, after all, it's for the best. Take your pistol, and we shall enter Dr. Roylott's room.
And it was a singular sight that met our eyes. On the table in Roylott's chamber stood the dark lantern, throwing a beam of light onto the safe, the door of which was ajar. Beside the table, on the wooden chair, sat Dr. Grimesby Roylott, clad in a long dressing gown, his bare feet thrust into red heelless Turkish slippers. Across his lap lay the short whip with the small loop tied in its end. But it was his face. His chin was cocked upwards, his eyes fixed on the ceiling in a dreadful rigid stare. Across his brow he had a peculiar yellow band with brownish speckles, which seemed to be bound tightly round his head.
The band. The speckled band.
For God's sake, Holmes. What is it?
Swamp adder. Most venomous snake in India. Death within 10 seconds. Indeed, does violence recoil on the violent and the schemer fall into the pit which he digs for another. And now, I'll try to distract it with a cane. You go for the noose, then into the safe.
Right. Right. Right!
Well done, old man. Well done.
What a dreadful way to die.
Oh, indeed.
And that cry. What agony he must... Why, Miss Stoner?
My heart. Oh.
Yeah, no, Miss Stoner, do not come in. There is nothing there you would want to see.
You are wrong, Mr. Holmes. I must see. I beg you to stand aside.
Miss Stoner.
What was it?
A snake, Miss Stoner. Another of the doctor's deadly pets, but one that turned on its master.
His face, just like Julius. So that's what he used. But why?
For the third of your mother's legacy that he would have lost by Julia's marriage as he would yours.
So monstrous a deed for so derisory a sum. Who would believe it?
Exactly. I wonder, Miss Stoner, if I might advance an idea with a view to canvassing your opinion. The doctor is dead through, it might be argued, his own carelessness. However, any hint that his death was not so simple would, I feel, lead to prolonged and searching inquiries, public inquiries, in which your name and that of your sister would figure largely. On the other hand, should Watson here go to the country police when it's light and inform them truly that the doctor has merely suffered from an accident, I have no doubt at all I could put you onto the train to your aunt tomorrow morning without you ever being bothered again regarding this matter. I stress that while this is not perhaps an ideal solution, it is possibly an acceptable one.
Mr. Holmes, may I, your arm... I would go closer if I might. Mr. Holmes, Dr. Watson, my view is that justice has been done. Now, please, help me back to my room.
A classic case, then, Doctor, of my reasoning from insufficient data and thereby coming to an entirely erroneous conclusion. The presence of the gypsies and the dead sister's use of the word band putting me entirely on the wrong scent. I can, however, claim the merit that I instantly reconsidered my position when it became clear that the danger could not have come from the window or the door, but must have been the work of an inside agency. Then, of course, came the discovery of the false bell pull. This hanging alongside the ventilator gave me the idea it was simply there as a bridge for something to pass through the ventilator and down to the bed. The notion of a snake came immediately, and as the doctor was furnished with a supply of creatures from India...
A wild coroner, of course.
Yeah, not a hope, Watson. A form of poison that could not be discovered by chemical test. While it would be a sharp-eyed coroner indeed who could distinguish the small punctures where the two fangs had done their work... Then there was the whistle. Of course, he must recall it before morning light and have trained it to return by use of the saucer of milk.
Kept near the safe, which in turn gave rise to the clang as the snake was locked in it during the day. But how would he know it would bite?
He did not. Not on any given occasion. He would simply slip the snake through the ventilator at the hour he thought best. With a certainty, it would crawl down the rope and land on the bed. Then, sooner or later, even if it took a week...
How truly horrible.
Indeed. Indeed. I had more or less come to these conclusions before I entered the doctor's room, the safe and the loop of whipcord merely adding to my conviction. What finally convinced me beyond all reasonable doubt, however, was the chair.
The chair?
You recall how closely I examined it with my glass.
Ah, yes.
What it told Watson was that Dr. Roylott was in the habit of standing on it, usually an unnecessary pastime, unless one wants to put something through a hole above one's head.
By Jove.
And it was simply a matter of baiting our trap and waiting for the strike. When it came in the shape of a hiss, I instantly lit the match and attacked the creature, arousing its snakish temper and driving it back through the ventilator where it flew at the first person it saw.
Indeed.
Which means, as you have gathered, that I am indirectly responsible for the death of Dr. Grimesby Roylott of Stoke Moran.
My dear fellow, you...
Although I cannot say it is likely to weigh very heavily on my conscience. Cigar?
In The Speckled Band... Sherlock Holmes was played by Clive Merrison and Dr. Watson by Michael Williams. Helen Stoner was played by Susan Wooldridge, with Jane Whittenshaw as Julia Stoner and Ian Lindsay as Dr. Grimesby Roylott. The violinist was Leonard Friedman. The Speckled Band was dramatized for radio by Vincent McInerney and directed by Patrick Rayner.
The next Sherlock Holmes adventure here on 4 Extra involves the engineer's thumb, and that's on Tuesday. You'll be pleased to know that Arthur's here and eager to get going. A BBC lawyer has told him he has to stay until midnight, though. Andrew O'Neill will be here for his final Seventh Dimension this week at midnight, and I'll be back at 1 with the crime and thrillers.
If at first you don't succeed, then do... No, hang on. If at first you don't succeed, then try... Oh, never mind. Welcome to the Comedy Club with me, Arthur Smith.
Welcome to the Comedy Club.
The Comedy Club.
The Comedy Club.
On BBC
Radio
4 Extra.
Wowee!
Coming up on tonight's show, solve your problems through music with Danny Robbins Music Therapy. Then at 11 o'clock, it's Lucy Montgomery's Variety Pack. At 11:30, Continuity with Alistair McGowan, Radio 4 announcements and big laughs. At 11:45, Confessions in Strangers on a Train. At midnight, find out yourself, I bet I'm going home. Just before 11, I'll be talking to John Lloyd, the great comedy giant who's produced more programmes than everyone else put together. But we start tonight with the Sinha test. Paul Sinha, a proudly English son of Indian immigrants, analyses divided loyalties in a comedic look at cricket and nationalism. From 2011, the Sinha test.
And there's a great hook shot, it's out of the ground.
That's a good shot.
Please welcome to the crease Paul Sinha in the Sinha test.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Paul Sinha. Welcome to the Midlands Arts Centre, situated opposite Edgbaston Cricket Ground in the beautiful, historic city of Birmingham. This summer, the Indian cricket team, the number one ranked test-playing nation in the world, will be playing at Edgbaston as part of what promises to be an exciting test series against a buoyant, ashes-conquering England. Not only will it see two extremely competitive rivals lock horns, but it will also be the farewell tour for Indian batting legend Sachin Tendulkar. Genius, hero, and a man only one innings away from scoring 100 international centuries. But as the proudly English son of Indian immigrants, who on earth will I be supporting? Or more to the point, who should I be supporting? To explain the title of the show, The Sinha Test, we need to go back 21 years to April 1990. The world was very different then. I was a first-year medical student in South London. The Bush family and the Bin Laden family were totally open about their friendship. And a man could make a perfectly good living as a Gary Glitter impersonator. And back in 1990, Norman Tebbit, the then Conservative MP for Chingford, was giving an interview to the Los Angeles Times. And in this interview, he said these words: "A large proportion of Britain's Asian population fail to pass the cricket test. Which side do they cheer for? It's an interesting test. Are you still harking back to where you came from or where you are?" And as he said these words, I can only imagine that the journalist at the Los Angeles Times was thinking, what in the devil's name is cricket? Well, to clarify for any American friends who may be listening, cricket is our version of baseball. Only with subtlety, nuance, a rich cultural heritage, a global audience, deeply complex tactics, and a general lack of steroid abuse. Cricket is the complete works of Shakespeare to baseball's The Only Way is Essex. Anyway, back to Norman. When I read what he had said, I couldn't quite believe it. I mean, I'm British Asian, a lot of my friends are, even my mum and dad are. And Norman Tebbit was just wrong. It wasn't a large proportion of Britain's Asian population. It was all of them. And I was definitely one of them. And yet, at no stage in my life had I considered myself unpatriotic. In the previous 10 years, I'd cheered royal weddings, the Oscars victory of Chariots of Fire, the raising of the Mary Rose, the stateside success of Duran Duran. 3 months after Norman Tebbit said his fateful words, Chris Waddle ineptly fired a penalty several miles over the crossbar against West Germany, and I wept actual tears of sadness. And yet, I had never once supported England in a game of cricket. To which the next question must be the same question people ask of the existence of Jedward. Why? To which the simple answer is, because my mum and dad supported India. A bit of background. My parents arrived in Britain in 1968. It's often wondered why so many people from the Indian subcontinent looked to the map of the world and chose Britain over the United States. Well, the clue is the decade, the 1960s. A reminder of the options. Birmingham, Alabama, Birmingham, West Midlands.